This is the September 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE based on the civil procedure cases which were summarized and posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in September 2020. Those summaries have been collected into the update pamphlet, which serves as the written materials for this course, and the page references are to that pamphlet. First case is on page 7. It's State versus M-Star Pizza, and it just deals with an abuse of discretion in connection with the appellant's request for an adjournment to find new counsel. Apparently, counsel had drawn up a settlement agreement on behalf of the appellant and others, and before signing the agreement, the appellant wanted the advice of new counsel and requested an adjournment for that. Second Department, reversing the Supreme Court, held that the appellant's request for an adjournment to find new counsel should have been granted. The appellant's attorney had also represented other respondents and had drawn up a settlement agreement. The appellant declined to sign the settlement, and the court entered a judgment against the appellant for nearly $800,000. The court wrote, "The granting of an adjournment for any purpose rests within the sound discretion of the court, and its determination will not be disturbed absent an improvident exercise of that discretion. In deciding whether to grant an adjournment, the court must engage in a balanced consideration of numerous relevant factors, including the merit or lack of merit of the proceeding, prejudice or lack thereof to the petitioner, the number of adjournments granted, the lack of intent to deliberately default or abandon the action, and the length of the pendency of the proceedings. Under the circumstances of this case, Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying the appellant's request for an adjournment to obtain new counsel. There was no prejudice to the petitioner, no lack of diligence by the appellant, and no substantial delay in the proceeding." So, the takeaway from this case: where there is no prejudice, no lack of diligence, and no substantial delay associated with the request for an adjournment to hire a new attorney, the failure to grant the adjournment is an abuse of discretion, and the $800,000 judgment here was reversed. Next is the Chara Labides case on pages 8 and 9. It deals with what must be an unusual situation where the judge would not sign a transcript and would not sign an order, and therefore prevented an appeal. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Dillon over a concurrence, held the plaintiff's only option when the judge refused to sign the transcript of the oral decision, that CPLR 2219, and in the alternative, refused to sign the proposed order with notice of settlement, and that site is 22 NYCRR 202.48A, was a mandamus proceeding to compel the judge to sign. Without the judge's signature, there was no appealable paper, and plaintiffs could not appeal the decision disqualifying plaintiff's counsel. Because the four-month statute of limitations for bringing an Article 78 mandamus action had long passed, the plaintiffs could not bring the appeal. The opinion includes a clear and comprehensive explanation of what constitutes appealable paper pursuant to CPLR 2219 and 22 NYCRR 202.48A, and this decision should be saved as a reference for that important legal discussion. The court wrote, "The justice failed or refused to sign the transcript of the proceedings, and therefore the transcript never qualified as an order for purposes of its enforcement or for an appeal. While the transcript bears the signature of the court reporter who certified its truth and accuracy, the court reporter's certification does not substitute for the plain and separate obligation set forth in CPLR 2219 subdivision A, that a judge or justice sign his or her name or initials to the document," and it references CPLR 5512 subdivision A. The absence of the justice's signature on the transcript had the effect of preventing the plaintiffs from directly appealing the adverse determination to the appellate division. Likewise, the justice failed or refused to sign the proposed order that was submitted to him with a copy of the transcript and with notice of settlement. Such an order, if signed with or without modification of its proposed language, would have become an enforceable order and subject to appeal. Parties are entitled to orders that are both enforceable and appealable, and those fundamental rights should not be thwarted by any jurist's unwitting failure to abide by the requirements of CPLR 2219, Subdivision A. Absent a proceeding pursuant to CPLR Article 78, the plaintiffs can receive no relief on this appeal. This court cannot compel, under the guise of CPLR 2219, Subdivision A, and 22 NYCRR 202.48, relief that can only be properly accomplished by mandamus, which is now untimely. So the takeaway here is, if a judge refuses to sign an order or a transcript and thereby prevents an appeal because there's no appealable paper, the only option is an Article 78 mandamus action to compel the judge to sign if the Article 78 is not brought within the 4-month statute of limitations. There can be no appeal of the order which wasn't signed. Next is the Astoria Landing case. On page 9, it just deals with the way courts should handle a motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action when the action is seeking a declaratory judgment. The Second Department noted that where a motion to dismiss an action for a declaratory judgment is made, the motion should be deemed a motion for a declaration in defendant's favor. The court wrote, the courts may consider the merits of a properly pleaded cause of action for a declaratory judgment upon a motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action where no questions of fact are presented by the controversy. Under such circumstances, the motion to dismiss the cause of action for failure to state a cause of action should be taken as a motion for a declaration in the defendant's favor and treated accordingly. So the simple point here is, where a motion to dismiss a declaratory judgment action on the ground that no cause of action was stated is made, it should be considered or treated as if the defendant had made a motion for a declaratory judgment in defendant's favor. Next is Newman on pages 10 and 11. It's another discussion of how a motion to dismiss a declaratory judgment action should be treated by the courts, and it also deals with the important issue of not including subsequent causes of action in the initial notice of claim. That will result in the dismissal of those subsequently brought causes of action. Second Department held the motion to dismiss the declaratory judgment action should have been treated as a motion for a declaration in the defendant's favor. The action concerned fines imposed on plaintiff homeowner by New York City for the alleged failure to have the in-home elevator inspected once a year. Plaintiff alleged the relevant regulations were unconstitutional. Plaintiff also included causes of action for breach of contract and promissory estoppel. The contract and estoppel causes of action were dismissed because they weren't included in the plaintiff's notice of claim. The regulations were deemed constitutional. So, with respect to the declaratory judgment cause of action and the notice of claim problem, the court wrote this. A motion to dismiss a declaratory judgment action prior to the service of an answer presents for consideration only the issue of whether a cause of action for declaratory relief is set forth, not the question of whether the plaintiff is entitled to a favorable declaration. Where a cause of action is sufficient to invoke the court's power to render a declaratory judgment as to the rights and other legal relations of the parties to a justiciable controversy, that's CPLR 3001 and CPLR 3017 Subdivision B, a motion to dismiss that cause of action should be denied. However, upon a motion to dismiss for failure to state a cause of action, a court may reach the merits of a properly pleaded cause of action for declaratory judgment where no questions of fact are presented by the controversy. Under those circumstances, the motion to dismiss the cause of action for failure to state a cause of action should be treated as one seeking a declaration in the defendant's favor and treated accordingly. Now, with respect to the causes of action that were not included in the notice of claim, the court wrote, a timely notice of claim is a condition precedent to the maintaining an action against the City of New York, citing Administrative Code Section 7-201. Here, the notice of claim attached to the complaint fails to include any allegations relating to the plaintiff's causes of action to recover damages for breach of contract and promissory estoppel, and therefore those causes of actions were not viable. So the takeaway here, if causes of action in the complaint were not identified in the notice of claim, and here those were the breach of contract and promissory estoppel causes of action, those causes of action will be dismissed. Next is Maldonado on page 11. Deals with a default judgment and law office failure. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to enter a default judgment in this pedestrian accident case should have been granted. The law office failure allegations were deemed insufficient. The court wrote, in order to successfully oppose a motion for leave to enter a default judgment, a defendant who has failed to timely appear or answer the complaint must provide a reasonable excuse for the default and also demonstrate the existence of a potentially meritorious defense to the action. Here, the defendant's conclusory explanation that their attorney misplaced the file and that the office was understaffed was insufficient to establish a reasonable excuse for the default. Since the defendants failed to demonstrate a reasonable excuse, this court need not consider whether they proffered a potentially meritorious defense to the action. Next is the London case on page 12. It's another case dealing with a motion for a default judgment, but this time it deals with the jurisdiction of a court to vacate a judgment. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the Nassau County Supreme Court could not vacate the default judgment issued by the New York County Supreme Court, even though the New York County Supreme Court had granted a change of venue to Nassau County. The court wrote, a motion to vacate an order must be addressed to the court that made the order, citing CPLR 5015 subdivision A, and no court other than the one that rendered the order may entertain a motion to vacate it. So the takeaway here is only the court which issued a default order can vacate it, even where there has been a valid change of venue. Next is the Slapo case on pages 12 and 13. It deals with unacceptable behavior during a deposition and what the courts can do about it. Second Department, over an extensive dissent, held Supreme Court properly issued a protective order limiting the deposition questioning of a doctor whose name was Brem in this medical malpractice action and properly ordered that the deposition be supervised. Both sides had engaged in misconduct at the prior deposition. The court wrote, Supreme Court providently exercised its discretion in granting those branches of the hospital's motion which were for a protective order to the extent of limiting further questioning of Brem solely to his observations and treatment of the ulcer sustained by the plaintiff, Slapo, and to direct that Brem's continued deposition be supervised by a special referee. While we agree with the court's characterization of the improper conduct of Slapo's attorney at Brem's deposition, we observe that the defense attorneys violated 22 NYCRR 221.1 by making numerous objections and making speaking objections. We further note that Brehm violated 22 NYCRR 221.2 by refusing to answer questions. Given the obstructive conduct by the defense attorneys and Brehm in violation of 22 NYCRR Part 22 and the improper conduct of Slapo's attorney during the deposition, we agree with the court that appropriate supervision of the balance of Brehm's deposition is necessary. Because both sides have engaged in arguably sanctionable conduct during the course of Brehm's deposition, it was inappropriate to compel the plaintiff to solely bear the cost of supervision. And without the consent of all parties, the court may not compel a party to pay for or contribute to the cost of an outside referee, citing CPLR 3104 subdivision B. Accordingly, we modify the order so as to direct that Brehm's continued deposition be supervised by a court-employed special referee, a judicial hearing officer, or a court attorney referee. So the takeaway here, if both sides are guilty of sanctionable obstructive conduct during a deposition, and they do not consent to paying for an outside referee, the court may appoint a referee to supervise the continued deposition. A witness's refusal to answer questions, frequent objections by the attorneys, and speaking objections, those are objections that are designed to influence a witness's answers, were among the sanctionable conduct which triggered the need for supervision of the deposition in this case. Next is 189 Schermerhorn Owners Company on pages 13 and 14. It deals with a motion to dismiss based on documentary evidence and the criteria for such a motion. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the Defendant Condominium Board of Managers motion to dismiss plaintiff condominium owner's complaint based on documentary evidence should have been granted. The court wrote, the plaintiff commenced this action against the Defendant Board of Managers, challenging the board's allocation of common expenses after the condominium's first year of operation in accordance with the first year budget set forth in the condominium offering plan. The plaintiff alleged that this method of allocating common expenses following the condominium's first year was a breach of the board's contractual duties and resulted in an overassessment of common charges to the plaintiff. The condominium offering plan, declaration, and bylaws utterly refuted the plaintiff's factual allegations and conclusively established a defense as a matter of law to the breach of contract cause of action. The plaintiff's allegation that the board was obligated to reallocate the common expenses after the first year of the condominium's operation, based upon an assessment of the commercial unit owner's actual use of and benefit from the services and other items covered by the common expenses, is refuted by the governing documents. So the takeaway here is evidence which fairly meets the strict criteria for documentary evidence within the meaning of CPLR 3211 subdivision A1, here that was the condominium offering plan, utterly refuted the factual allegations made by the plaintiff in this breach of contract action. The complaint, therefore, should have been dismissed. If, as it appears, the motion court was wrong on the law, perhaps a motion to reargue explaining the legal requirements for documentary evidence as an alternative to an appeal would have succeeded here. Next is the Twinkle Play case, pages 14 and 15, again dealing with a motion to dismiss based upon documentary evidence. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to dismiss the breach of contract cause of action should not have been granted. The court wrote, a party seeking dismissal pursuant to CPLR 3211 subdivision A1 on the ground that its defense is based on documentary evidence, must submit documentary evidence that resolves all factual issues as a matter of law and conclusively disposes of the plaintiff's claim. In order for evidence to qualify as documentary, it must be unambiguous, authentic, and undeniable. The takeaway here, this presents the mirror image of the scenario in the previous case. Here the evidence, which wasn't described in the decision, didn't meet the strict criteria for documentary evidence within the meaning of CPLR 3211A1, and the judge should not have dismissed the complaint. Again, a motion to re-argue explaining the legal requirements for documentary evidence may have succeeded in this case. Next, on pages 15 and 16, is CD versus Goshen Central School District. It's another case which illustrates the importance of including causes of action in the notice of claim. Second Department held defendant's motion to dismiss claims that were not in the notice of claim was properly granted, and plaintiff's motions to amend the notice of claim and for leave to file a late notice of claim were properly denied. The action alleged negligent supervision by the school. Plaintiff student was allegedly pushed into a wall during a gym class by another student who had been bullying her for some time. The court wrote, the plaintiff's new claims of other purported bullying incidents and plaintiff student's father's claim that he suffered stress, anxiety, and depression as a result of the incident constitute new theories of liability which were not included in the notice of claim and should be dismissed. The plaintiff's proposed amendments to the notice of claim add substantive new facts and new theories of liability not set forth in the original notice of claim and which are not permitted as late filed amendments to the notice of claim under General Municipal Law, Section 50-E, Subdivision 6. The plaintiff's failure to include a proposed notice of claim with their cross motion alone was a sufficient basis for denying that branch of the cross motion. So the takeaway here, notices of claim are important. Theories or factual allegations not in the notice of claim will be dismissed. New theories or facts are not permitted as late filed amendments pursuant to the General Municipal Law. And that subsection of Section 50E of the General Municipal Law reads, mistake, omission, irregularity, or defect. At any time after the service of a notice of claim, and at any stage of an action or special proceeding to which the provision of this section are applicable, a mistake, omission, irregularity, or defect made in good faith in the notice of claim required to be served by this action, by this section, not pertaining to the manner or time of service thereof, may be corrected, supplied, or disregarded, as the case may be, in the discretion of the court, provided it shall appear that the other party was not prejudiced thereby. So that's the provision of the General Municipal Law which allows amendments to a notice of claim. But as this case makes clear, if you're trying to add a theory or new facts in an amended notice, it won't be allowed. Next is One West Bank, pages 16 and 17. It deals with the criteria for an finding that a cause of action or an action was abandoned, failure to prosecute. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the action should not have been dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3216 for failure to prosecute because issue was never joined in the action. And the court wrote, CPLR 3216B1 states that no dismissal should be made under this statute unless issue has been joined. A court may not dismiss an action based on neglect to prosecute unless the CPLR 3216 statutory preconditions to dismissal are met. Here, none of the defendants submitted an answer to the complaint, and thus the issue was never joined, since at least one precondition set forth in CPLR 3216 was not met. The Supreme Court was without power to issue an order conditionally dismissing the action pursuant to that statute. So the takeaway here, where issue has not been joined, a motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute will not fly. Next is Nation Star Mortgage on pages 17 and 18. It deals with the proof necessary to obtain a hearing on the issue of whether a defendant was properly served. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held plaintiff's motion to enter a default judgment in this foreclosure action should not have been granted without first holding a hearing on defendant's claim she was never served with the complaint. The defendant presented proof including a lease demonstrating she did not live at the address where service was made. The fact that defendant had not updated her address with the Department of Motor Vehicles did not preclude defendant from demonstrating she lived at a different address because there was no evidence of a deliberate misrepresentation to prevent service. The court wrote, the defendant successfully rebutted the process server's affidavits through her specific averments that at the time of each purported service, neither the New York Avenue address nor the subject premises was her residence, actual dwelling place, or usual place of abode. Rather, the defendant averred that at the time of each purported service, she resided at an address on Albany Avenue in Brooklyn. The defendant annexed to her affidavit her lease for the Albany Avenue premises, covering the period which encompassed the dates of service. She also included money orders made payable to the Albany Avenue landlord within the lease period and the defendant's W-2 bearing the Albany Avenue address. Also, utility bills during the lease period bearing the Albany Avenue address and bank statements during the same period with that address on them. These records, in conjunction with the defendant's sworn statements, are evidence that the defendant did not reside at the locations where the process was served and were sufficient to warrant a hearing. So the takeaway here, the fact that the defendant did not update her address with the Department of Motor Vehicles did not preclude her from demonstrating she didn't live at the address where service of process was made. Again, she presented a lease, proof of payment of rent and utility bills and bank statements with a different address, and the motion court should have held a hearing to determine the validity of the service. Next is Lehman Brothers on page 19. It deals with the sua sponte powers to dismiss a cause of action. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, noted that the judge should not have, sua sponte, vacated the judgment of foreclosure as against those defendants who didn't move for that relief. The court wrote, a court's power to dismiss a complaint, sua sponte, is to be used sparingly and only when extraordinary circumstances exist to warrant dismissal. The defense of lack of jurisdiction based upon improper service is personal in nature and may only be raised by the party improperly served. Here, the defendant Hickson was the only defendant who moved to vacate the judgment of foreclosure and sale and to dismiss the complaint for lack of personal jurisdiction. Accordingly, Supreme Court had no basis to sua sponte vacate so much of the judgment of foreclosure and sale as was against the defendants other than Hickson, and to direct the dismissal of the complaint insofar as asserted against those defendants for lack of personal jurisdiction. So the takeaway here, the judge didn't have the power to dismiss the complaint on its own motion, sua sponte, as against defendants who didn't move to dismiss for a lack of personal jurisdiction. Only a party who has been improperly served can raise the lack of personal jurisdiction defense. Here, there were no extraordinary circumstances to justify the court's unilateral action. Next is Goshen Mortgage on page 20. It deals with an issue that's unique to foreclosure. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the mortgage debt had not been reaccelerated by an amended complaint in 2009, rendering the foreclosure action time-barred. The court wrote, the defendant submitted the supplemental summons and amended complaint filed on July 13, 2009, in the 2005 action. In the amended complaint, the bank, or the plaintiff, PCG, elected to reaccelerate the debt, which started the running of a new six-year period. The defendants established that the time in which to sue expired on July 22, 2015, 6 years after the service of the supplemental summons and amended complaint. That's citing CPLR 213 subdivision 4. The plaintiff's counsel having conceded that the loan was accelerated as of that time. So the takeaway of this case is, again, it's an issue unique to foreclosure actions. The statute of limitations for foreclosure starts when the debt is accelerated, meaning that when the entire debt is called in, usually by the commencement of a foreclosure action. The question in this particular case was whether an invalid amended complaint, which was served without leave of court, triggered the statute of limitations. The court held that it did, and the action was therefore time-barred, and it's worth noting that the bank or the plaintiff's attorney conceded that although the amended complaint itself was not valid, it did serve to accelerate the debt. Next is Wells Fargo. On page 21, another foreclosure action that deals with the acceleration of a debt. Second Department held that the plaintiff bank did not prove the debt had been de-accelerated and therefore didn't demonstrate the foreclosure action was not time-barred. It was not demonstrated that the stipulation of discontinuance affirmatively revoked the initial acceleration of the debt. The court wrote, a lender may revoke its election to accelerate the mortgage, but it must do so by an affirmative act of revocation occurring during the six-year statute of limitations period subsequent to the initiation of the prior foreclosure action. The only evidence submitted by the plaintiff to establish its affirmative act of revocation was a printout of the Queens County Clerk minutes showing that a stipulation of discontinuance and a consent to cancel the list pendants were filed in the 2008 foreclosure action on July 2013. The plaintiff did not submit a copy of the stipulation of discontinuance. A stipulation of discontinuance will not, by itself, constitute an affirmative act of revocation where the stipulation is silent on the issue of the election to accelerate, and it does not otherwise indicate that the plaintiff would accept installment payments from the defendant. So this case presents another foreclosure-related statute of limitations question. If the foreclosure action is discontinued by stipulation, is the debt de-accelerated such that the statute of limitations stops running? The answer is no. The stipulation of discontinuance standing alone does not de-accelerate the debt, and the statute of limitations keeps running. Next is another case involving Wells Fargo Bank. It's on page 22, and it's included here just because the court talked about when new evidence submitted in reply can be considered. It's another foreclosure case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff bank's reply papers were properly considered, but the plaintiff didn't submit sufficient proof that a condition precedent in the mortgage agreement with respect to the notice of default was complied with. The Supreme Court providently exercised its discretion in considering the affidavit of the plaintiff's employee, Jeremiah Herberg, which was submitted with the plaintiff's papers in opposition to the defendant's cross motion and in further support of its motion. Although a party moving for summary judgment generally cannot meet its prima facie burden by submitting evidence for the first time in reply. There are exceptions to the general rule, including when the other party is given an opportunity to respond to the reply papers. Here, the defendant had the opportunity to address the Herberg affidavit in her reply papers in further support of her own cross motion. So the takeaway, evidence submitted for the first time in reply papers can be considered by the court if the opposing party has a chance to respond. Next is the trust case. On page 24, it's another foreclosure case dealing with the issue of standing, but it's included here because it discusses the requirements for submission of an out-of-state affidavit. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff bank's motion for summary judgment in this foreclosure action should not have been granted. Although it was not determinative, the out-of-state affidavit lacked a certificate of conformity. The court wrote, "We note that the out-of-state affidavit from the vice president of loan documentation for Wells Fargo lacked a certificate of conformity as required by CPLR 2309 subdivision C, although such defect by itself would not be fatal to the plaintiff's motion." So the takeaway here is an out-of-state affidavit should be accompanied by a certificate of conformity, which is required by CPLR 2309 subdivision C, but the failure to include that certificate may not be the sole reason for denying the relief. Next, on page 25, another foreclosure case involving Wells Fargo Bank. It's included here because of the discussion of the hearsay evidence that was relied upon by the referee. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the referee's report should not have been confirmed. The evidence of default presented to the referee was hearsay, and the referee did not hold a hearing on notice as required by CPLR 4320. The court wrote, "With respect to the amount due to the plaintiff, the referee based his findings on the affidavit of Nicholas Robb, an employee of Specialized Loan Servicing, the plaintiff's loan servicing agent for the subject loan. While Robb provided a proper foundation for the admission of business records made by a prior servicer, he failed to attach the business records themselves to his affidavit. Accordingly, Robb's assertions regarding the date of the defendant's default in making her mortgage payments, the total sum due to the plaintiff, which included the amount of accrued interest calculated from the date of the default, and amounts purportedly paid in an escrow advance for the property preservation, without the business records themselves, constituted inadmissible hearsay." Next is the Castaldini case, which is on page 27. It deals with proof at an inquest on damages after there's been a default by the defendant. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the injured plaintiffs, that's Castaldini's, treating physician should have been made available for cross-examination by the defendant at the inquest on damages. Defendant had defaulted on liability, but appeared at the inquest. Supreme Court accepted an affidavit from the doctor to prove damages. The court wrote, "We disagree with the Supreme Court's determination to admit into evidence the written sworn statement of Castaldini's treating physician without making the physician available for cross-examination. At an inquest to ascertain damages upon a defendant's default, the plaintiff may submit proof by written sworn statements of the witnesses," and that's citing CPLR 3215B and 22 NYCRR 202.46B. "However, whereas here, the defaulting defendant gives notice that he or she will appear at the inquest, the plaintiff must make the witnesses available for cross-examination," again citing CPLR 3215B. "Since plaintiff did not make the physician available for cross-examination, the court should not have admitted into evidence the physician's written sworn statement over the defendant's objection. Further, since the court relied on the physician's statement in making its findings of fact on damages, we remit the matter to Supreme Court for a new inquest on the issue of damages. So the takeaway here, a defendant who defaults but gives notice and appears for the inquest on damages has the right to cross-examine plaintiff's witnesses. Next is Matter of Crown Castle on page 28. It deals with a late submission of a judgment after a party has been directed to submit a judgment to the judge and it's 60 days, the 60-day deadline is not met. The Second Department held Supreme Court properly accepted a judgment submitted after the 60-day deadline rather than deeming the judgment abandoned. The court wrote, 22 NYCRR 202.48 requires that a judgment be submitted within 60 days after the filing of the decision directing its submission, and failure to timely submit the judgment shall be deemed an abandonment of the proceeding. However, it's within the sound discretion of the court to accept a belated order or judgment for settlement. A court should not deem an action or judgment abandoned where the result would not bring the repose to court proceedings that 22 NYCRR 202.48 was designed to effectuate and would waste judicial resources. Here, the Supreme Court providently exercised its discretion in accepting the petitioner's judgment despite its untimely submission, since doing so brought finality to the proceedings and preserved judicial resources. So the takeaway is where a decision directs the submission of a judgment for settlement pursuant to 22 NYCRR 202.48, that provision requires that the judgment be submitted within 60 days. But the court has the discretion to accept a late submission rather than deem the action abandoned. Next is Matter of KG versus the City of New York. It's on page 29. It deals with a petition for leave to file a late notice of claim, but the real issue here is whether the right party was named. If the wrong party was named, the action will be deemed to have had no merit. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the motion for leave to file a late notice of claim in this lead paint exposure case should not have been granted with respect to the defendant, City of New York. Plaintiff alleged exposure to lead in an apartment owned by the New York City Housing Authority, which is an entity separate from the city. The court wrote, Supreme Court should have denied the petition on the ground that the claim, as it was asserted against the city, is patently meritless. Liability for a dangerous condition on real property must be predicated upon ownership, occupancy, control, or special use of the property. It's undisputed that the apartment building in which the infant petitioner resided at the time of his injury was owned and operated by the New York City Housing Authority, an entity which is separate from New York City. So the practice point here, in a New York City lead paint exposure case involving a housing authority apartment, the New York City Housing Authority is the property defendant, not the City of New York. Next is the Incorporated Village of Lindenhurst on page 30. It's a municipal law case dealing with the issue of preemption by the state environmental law. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the village's request for a preliminary injunction limiting the amount of waste that could be processed by defendant recycling company was properly denied, but the action seeking a permanent injunction should not have been dismissed. The Department of Environmental Conservation, that's the DEC, had issued a temporary emergency permit allowing the defendant to process 1,100 tons of waste per day, and the defendant applied to make 1,100 tons per day a permanent limit. The village sought an injunction imposing the 2008 limit of 370 tons per day. While the preliminary injunction was pending, the DEC issued a permit imposing a daily waste limit of 500 tons per day, which obviated the need for the preliminary injunction. But because the state has not preempted the ability of a municipality to regulate the amount of waste, the permanent injunction action should not have been dismissed. The court wrote, Supreme Court erred in determining that it did not have the authority to issue declaratory or injunctive relief, limiting the maximum amount of waste that could be processed at the facility in an amount less than that permitted by the DEC. The state has not preempted local legislation of issues related to municipal solid waste management. Thus, the DEC's issuance of the 2016 renewal permit did not per se preclude the court from considering the merits of the causes of action asserted in the village's complaint. So the takeaway here, state environmental laws have not preempted a municipality's authority to regulate the allowed amount of waste disposal within that municipality. Next is Matter of Mulford Bay on page 31. It deals with what a court can do when a necessary party has not been included in the lawsuit. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held a petition seeking review of the Village Planning Board's decision with respect to the petitioner's application for approval of a subdivision should not have been dismissed. Because the Planning Board's decision affected another landowner called 160 South Ocean, Supreme Court dismissed the petition for failure to include a necessary party. The Second Department held Supreme Court should have ordered the party summoned pursuant to CPLR 1001 Subdivision B. The court wrote, 160 South Ocean is a necessary party to this proceeding, subject to the jurisdiction of the court, and therefore the Supreme Court should have ordered it summoned rather than denying the petition and dismissing the proceeding for failure to join a necessary party, again citing CPLR 1001 Subdivision B. We reinstate the petition and remit the matter to Supreme Court for further proceedings, including a determination on the merits of respondent's motion. So the takeaway here, the court pursuant to CPLR 1001B can itself order a necessary party summoned where the court has the authority to order the missing party summoned because it has jurisdiction over the party. There's no need to dismiss the action for failure to include a necessary party. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this September 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The verification code is necessary. Again, the verification code for this September 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE is necessary. Next is Board of Managers on page 32. It deals with the ability to dismiss an action when there's a pending action seeking the same relief and involving the same parties. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held a cause of action should have been dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3211A4 because it involved the same parties and sought the same relief as a pending action. The actions involved common charges for condominiums. The court wrote, pursuant to 3211, CPLR 3211A4, a party may move to dismiss a cause of action on the ground that there's another action pending between the same parties for the same cause of action in a court of any state or the United States. It's not necessary that the precise legal theories presented in the first action also be presented in the second action, as long as the relief is the same or substantially the same. The critical element is that both suits arise out of the same subject matter or series of alleged wrongs. The resolution of the cause of action against the board, the condominium board, which include, among other things, a request for a judgment declaring that the board's common charge increases were not valid, may moot the instant action to foreclose upon the common charge liens. Further, absent relief under CPLR 3211A4, there would be duplicative litigation and the prospect of inconsistent results. So the takeaway here, an action can be dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3211A4 if there's a pending action involving the same parties and seeking substantially the same relief. Next is You versus Hussein. And U is spelled U-Y. It's on page 33, collateral estoppel case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court in this pedestrian vehicle accident case, held one, a ruling by the Unemployment Insurance Appeal Board finding that the defendant driver was an employee of defendant Uber was not entitled to collateral estoppel effect. And that's because of a statute, labor law, section 623, subdivision 2. And two, although the labor law 623, subdivision 2 argument was not raised below, it raised a question of law which could not have been avoided below and therefore was properly considered on appeal. And three, the claim that defendant driver had logged off the Uber app at the time of the accident did not warrant summary judgment in favor of Uber on the vicarious liability theory. So here an Uber driver was in a traffic accident, and the question was whether Uber may be vicariously liable. Although the Unemployment Insurance Appeal Board found that the driver was an Uber employee, pursuant to the labor law section 623.2, that finding is not entitled to collateral estoppel effect. Whether the driver was an employee acting within the scope of his employment at the time of the traffic accident was therefore a question for the jury. Next is Garrow versus Pittsburgh Logistics, page 35. And it deals with the requirements of service of process under the business corporation law. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's failure to make diligent efforts to serve defendant in accordance with business corporation law section 307 required dismissal of the complaint. The court wrote, because the failure to strictly comply with the procedures of business corporation law section 307 constitutes a jurisdictional defect rather than a mere irregularity, the 30-day time period in business corporation law section 307 is not subject to extension under CPLR 2004. Plaintiffs did not make reasonably diligent efforts to comply with the procedures of Business Corporation Law Section 307. Although plaintiffs personally delivered the summons with notice to an authorized agent of the Secretary of State and sent a copy of the summons with notice by registered mail, return receipt requested, to the address that the corporation PLS had registered with the Bureau of Corporations within the Pennsylvania Department of State, they made absolutely no effort to thereafter file the affidavit of compliance and the requisite accompanying documents. The excuse provided for plaintiff's failure to timely serve the corporation in accordance with the Business Corporation Law Section 307 amounts to law office failure, an excuse that has been held to be insufficient to constitute good cause. As plaintiffs did not make the requisite showing, they are not entitled to an extension upon good cause under CPLR Section 306B. So the takeaway here is the failure to comply with the strict service requirements of Business Corporation Law 307 is a jurisdictional defect for which law office failure is an inadequate excuse. Next is Greenberg on page 36. It deals with the statute of limitations in the context of a continuing wrong. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff stated causes of action for unjust enrichment, breach of fiduciary duty, and an accounting against her sister, who was named Weissel, the sole manager of A&Z, of which plaintiff is also a member. The court noted that the allegation that Weissel did not transfer assets to A&Z alleged a continuing wrong, so payments allegedly owed to A&Z within the statute of limitations period were actionable. So the takeaway here, where an action alleges a continuing wrong, here the failure to make periodic payments, the payments which should have been made within the six-year statute of limitations are actionable. Next is matter of Shara Labella Hoppenstein on page 37. It just deals with the kind of evidence that will support proof that there was a good faith effort to settle. Second Department, reversing Surrogates Court, held the appellant's counsel submissions demonstrating a good faith effort to settle the matter pursuant to 22 NYCRR 202.7 were sufficient. So the takeaway here is the emails submitted by the attorney were deemed sufficient evidence of good faith effort, an effort to settle pursuant to 22 NYCRR 202.7. The court doesn't explain what was in the emails, but it's worth noting that email communications by an attorney can be sufficient for this purpose. Next is Matter of Gorlick on page 38. It deals with a judge's obligations when converting an action to a summary judgment action. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge, after converting the Article 78 petition to a complaint, should not have, sua sponte, dismissed the complaint without notifying the parties. The court wrote, the Supreme Court denied the comptroller's motion to dismiss, and pursuant to CPLR 103 subdivision C, converted the Article 78 petition into a complaint asserting a declaratory judgment cause of action. Upon reaching the merits of the plaintiff's complaint, the court sua sponte denied the plaintiff declaratory judgment relief and directed dismissal of the complaint. Upon converting the Article 78 petition into a complaint, Supreme Court erred in reaching the merits of the complaint and directing its dismissal. Having converted the petition to a complaint, the court could only reach the merits by giving the parties adequate notice that it was going to treat the defendant's pre-answer motion to dismiss as one for summary judgment, citing CPLR 3211 subdivision C. The defendant had not served an answer to either the petition or the complaint, and therefore any motion for summary judgment would have been premature, citing CPLR 3212 subdivision A. The record does not establish that the parties deliberately charted a summary judgment course. Under these circumstances, the court's determination on the merits of the complaint was premature. So the takeaway, the court cannot treat a motion to dismiss as a motion for summary judgment without notice to the parties. And the final case in this September 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE is on page 39. Gorakova versus Consolidated Edison of New York. It has to do with the burden of proof in a damages-only trial. The Second Department ordering a new trial in this personal injury action, which had resulted in a $5.5 million verdict, determined the burden of proof jury instruction should not have been given in this damages-only trial. The court wrote, we agree with the defendants that under the facts of this case, the Supreme Court's determination to charge pattern jury instruction 1:60 was improper in the context of a trial limited to the issue of damages only, and was prejudicial to the defendants in that it shifted the burden of proof. In light of the court's error in the charge, substantial justice was not done since the jury was not instructed with the germane legal principles to be applied. So the takeaway here, civil pattern jury instruction, that's PJI, section 1:60 was not appropriate in this damages-only trial. PJI 1:60 instructs the jury to analyze the burden of proof by weighing the evidence presented by both sides, which was here deemed inappropriate for determining damages only. And that concludes this September 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE.